From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen to excerpts of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches, including the first one he gave at the start of the Montgomery bus boycott. Our guest will be historian Claiborne Carson. He co-edited a new book and cassette collection of King's civil rights speeches, and he directs the King Papers Project. Also, we meet rhythm and blues singer and guitarist Barbara Lynn. She's best known for her 1962 hit, You'll Lose a Good Thing. She's making a comeback with a new CD called Hot Night Tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Diplomats, politicians, and religious leaders joined the family of Martin Luther King Jr. today at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta to celebrate King's legacy. Maura Farrelly reports from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta.
Calling the federal holiday a day on rather than a day off, Coretta Scott King reminded the crowd at today's commemorative service that her husband's legacy was about the power of nonviolent action to effect change. She said that nonviolent societies are made up of people who embrace nonviolent lifestyles.
And that means achieving stronger gun control, eliminating the death penalty, reducing military spending, refusing to support violent movies and music, and living a nonviolent life.
King also spoke of what she called the violence of poverty, and she appealed to the U.S. government to battle the problem of poverty in Africa by forgiving the national debts of some of the world's poorest nations. For NPR News, I'm Maura Farrelly in Atlanta.
President Clinton observed the King holiday in Washington, where he briefly joined AmeriCorps volunteers in painting at a senior citizen's home and accepted an award for his work on civil rights. He said his parting wish for the nation would be, in his words, that we become more the one America that we know we ought to be. President-elect Bush spoke to invited guests at an elementary school in Houston. He was joined by his nominee for Secretary of Education, Rod Paige, who's credited with improving academic performance as the head of the Houston School District. Bush praised the desegregation of Southern schools, but he said the dream of equality is empty unless all students have access to high-quality schools. Middle East peace efforts were hampered today by fresh violence on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Peace talks were called off today but are expected to resume tomorrow. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Jerusalem on today's violence and the reaction to it.
Palestinians, probably from Khan Yunis in the southwestern part of the Gaza Strip, killed a settler who was working in the orchard of a fortified Jewish enclave nearby. Israel immediately slapped maximum security measures on the Gaza Strip. Roads linking the main towns closed, airport closed, borders with Egypt and Israel closed, even the eastern crossing point for goods. Food, medicine, and building materials enter Gaza there, but also piecework sent by Israeli companies that use cheap Palestinian labor in Gaza. Such Israeli companies are also hard hit by the closures. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The death toll is rising in the San Salvador earthquake, where nearly 600 people are now confirmed dead. About 1,000 people are still unaccounted for in a landslide at Las Colinas, about 3 miles from the capital, San Salvador. The earthquake destroyed or damaged thousands of homes, leaving thousands of people homeless. Many people whose houses are still standing were left without electric power or safe water. This is NPR. The FBI has increased the reward for 7 men who escaped from a Texas prison in mid-December. The federal agency has added another $140,000, raising the reward to $440,000. The 7 men are reported to be very heavily armed. They're suspected in the murder of a police officer at a Dallas-area sporting goods store. Police say they're hoping the additional money will encourage someone who may be helping the fugitives to turn them in. Authorities are also searching for 2 inmates who escaped early today from Oklahoma's maximum security prison. Kelly Burley reports from member station KOSU in Stillwater.
The 2 inmates escaped from the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister after they removed the toilets from their cells to gain access to a crawl space. James Robert Thomas and Willie Lee Hoffman went through an air duct and made it to the roof before reaching the ground. The inmates then climbed over 2 fences and escaped. A 3rd inmate was caught between the fences and captured. The inmates turned up missing at about 5 o'clock this morning. The escapees later stole a car in McAllister, but authorities aren't sure which direction they're headed. Thomas is serving life without parole for murder and rape. Hoffman is doing a 20-year stint for kidnapping and other convictions. Both are considered dangerous, but authorities say there is no indication they're armed. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Burley in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Motorola says it plans to stop making cellular phones at one of its factories in the Chicago area. The giant wireless company says it will lay off about 2,500 workers, or nearly 2% of its workforce. Motorola plans to keep the plant at Harvard, Illinois, open, but will use it for product development and filling customer orders. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we talk about the civil rights speeches of Martin Luther King.
Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of that character, not on the basis of the color of that skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied.
That's an excerpt of Martin Luther King's address to the 11th Annual Convention of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta in August of 1967. Some of King's most famous speeches, as well as some previously unpublished ones, are collected in a new book and a companion series of cassettes called A Call to Conscience. My guest, Claiborne Carson, is the co-editor of this project. He also directs the King Papers Project, which is responsible for editing and publishing King's writings. Carson is a history professor at Stanford University. We invited him to choose a few excerpts from King's speeches and to share some of his thoughts about them. Let's start with King's first civil rights speech. He delivered it on the first day of the Montgomery bus boycott in December of 1955. I asked Claiborne Carson about the occasion for the speech.
We wouldn't be talking about Martin Luther King if not for Rosa Parks, because it was her action on December 1st, 1955, of refusing to give up her seat on a bus that started the Montgomery bus boycott. And it was actually Rosa Parks and Montgomery women who thought up the idea of the boycott and passed around thousands of leaflets and were able to successfully get nearly all of Montgomery's black residents to stay off the buses on Monday the 5th. And at that point, the ministers in town, most of them, and all of the men, decided to get together and form the Montgomery Improvement Association. And that was when they selected Martin Luther King to lead this boycott movement that had already begun. And he was asked to address a major rally that was going to be held at Holt Street Baptist Church that night. And as he recalled later, he only had a few minutes, maybe 15 to 20 minutes, to prepare what was the most decisive speech of his life, because this was his first major speech to a public audience.
He says that this is a movement of Christians, that he wants it said that we are not here advocating violence. The only weapon that we have in our hands this evening is the weapon of protest. Where was he when he gave this speech in his thinking, in his development about civil disobedience?
Well, first of all, he was not really accomplished practitioner of Gandhian nonviolence. At that point, he even a few weeks later applies for a gun permit, which might be surprising. He had not really made his commitment to nonviolence, or at least Gandhian nonviolence, as a philosophy of life. That would come later. But even at this early stage, he understands that nonviolence is a necessity as a tactic. And I think that what you see coming out of this speech is an understanding of how it was related to the long-term struggle for civil rights under the Constitution of the United States.
What did he plan on doing with the gun, do you know?
Well, it was for protection. He got many threats during the first few weeks of the protests. There was times when he thought that he had made a mistake by agreeing to become the leader. Rosa Parks, she writes an introduction to this speech for the volume. And one of the things that she points out is that part of the reason why King was selected was because he was new. And therefore, as a minister in town, he didn't have any enemies. There was also the thought that maybe a young person without a lot of responsibilities, if someone had to go to jail, it might as well be him as opposed to maybe a minister with a large family or someone else like that. But I think it was largely the fact that he was the newcomer in town and he hadn't really developed the enemies that might have come later.
There's a couple of short excerpts from this first civil rights speech that Martin Luther King gave that you'd like us to hear. Would you introduce the first part for us?
Well, I think that when we look at this speech, we see so many of the themes that he develops in his later speeches that are also included in the volume, particularly his understanding that the movement is about gaining, realizing the ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So in this excerpt, he talks about if we are wrong, if we in Montgomery who are carrying on this protest are wrong, the Supreme Court of the nation is wrong, the Constitution is wrong, God Almighty is wrong. So I think he develops that theme with a passion and an eloquence that is remarkable.
This is Martin Luther King on December 5th, 1955.
And we are not wrong. We are not wrong in what we are doing. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. If we are wrong, Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dream and never came down to earth. If we are wrong, justice is a law. And we are determined here in Montgomery to rock and fight until justice runs down like water.
That was an excerpt of Martin Luther King's first civil rights speech given in 1955. Claiborne Carson has just edited a book and a set of cassettes called A Call to Conscience, collecting the civil rights speeches of Martin Luther King. Claiborne Carson, what would you say about Martin Luther King's oratory style in this first civil rights speech compared to his style later on?
Well, I think, first of all, you see how he is such an accomplished orator, even at this early stage. At this point, he is still 26 years old. He is a person who has only spent a year as a minister of a church, but yet you see that power, that confidence. The fact that he only had a few minutes to prepare the speech meant that most of it was going to be extemporaneous. I think that what you see there is a remarkably accomplished orator at a very young age.
Let's skip ahead to the end of this first civil rights speech given by Martin Luther King. Tell us a little bit about what to listen for.
Well, again, what King tries to do here is try to take a local event. At this point, it's a one-day bus boycott. So we don't even know that it's going to succeed. We don't even know if it's going to go on for any length of time. it actually ends up going on for more than a year, but we don't know that at this time. But what King is able to do at the end of that first day is tell his audience that they are involved in a historic protest, something that will be written about in the history books of the future. And he understands that this is an important moment in African-American history. There lived a race of people, a black people, a people who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and they had injected new meaning into the veins of history and civilization.
Let's hear his conclusion to this speech.
As we stand and sit here this evening, and as we prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, let us go out with the grim and bold determination that we are going to stick together. We are going to work together.
That's the end of Martin Luther King's first civil rights speech given at the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott in December of 1955. When Martin Luther King was talking about this being the beginning of a very important movement, do you think he had any idea that he would be the leader of that movement?
I think he understood that he was going to play a leadership role because at that time, that's what black ministers did. His father had been a minister. His grandfather had been a minister. His great-grandfather had been a minister. His grandfather and his father had been leaders of the NAACP. So he understood that he was going to play a leadership role. That was one of the reasons why he became a minister, because it was one of the few areas where a black person was able to perform a leadership role, but also have a certain amount of independence, because it was one of the few professions where a black person was not dependent upon whites to pay their salary. So I think the leadership was always there. He didn't understand the scale of the leadership. I think that that was something that was more thrust upon him. And I think he had a lot of ambivalence about that, because he saw it, civil rights leadership, as subordinate to his role as being a minister. Eventually, that began to take over from that role and began to become the center of his life, something that dominated his life, even to the point where he was not able to often show up on Sunday morning to deliver the sermon and to take care of his family responsibilities.
My guest is Claiborne Carson, co-editor of the new book and cassette collections of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches. It's called A Call to Conscience. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Claiborne Carson, co-editor of A Call to Conscience, a new book and cassette collection of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches. Let's skip ahead to the final speech that Martin Luther King gave, and this was the day before he was assassinated. This was April 3rd of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. What was the occasion of this address?
Well, this was one of those addresses that he hadn't planned to give. He had been called back to Memphis. In some ways, Memphis as a whole was one of the accidents of the movement. He had not intended that to be the major focuses of his activity, but the Memphis garbage workers' strike was something that he could not avoid. The first decision he makes is not to go at all. He's very tired, very exhausted. He wants to send Ralph Abernathy to speak for him. But quickly he gets the message that the people there are very, very excited. They're very enthusiastic. They want to hear him. And he decides to come. And, of course, at this point he doesn't have a prepared text. But what's remarkable about the speech, he obviously doesn't know it's going to be his last speech, but in it, he's able to look back over his career and reflect on the meaning of it. And he goes through and talks about the incident in 1958 when he is stabbed by a deranged woman who stabs him with a knife that comes very close to his heart. His doctor tells him if he had sneezed, he would have died because that would have punctured his heart. And he says, I'm glad I didn't sneeze, because if I had not lived past that, I would not have been there for the sit-ins in 1960, for the freedom rides. So he understands the significance of his life and how these events have culminated in the Memphis struggle.
This is the speech that's most famous for his lines about how he'd been to the mountaintop.
That's right. But I think that's the part of the speech, just the way I would compare it would be, we only hear often the I Have a Dream speech, we only hear the end of it. And many of the most interesting parts are before that, but King, to some degree, has been reduced to a soundbite. And I think the same with the last speech. We tend to hear the last part, I've been to the mountaintop, which of course is a great culmination, a great climax to the speech. But the earlier part of the speech, I think, is the most interesting, the most revealing, because that's where he's able to articulate his understanding of the importance of his own life.
There's a particular moment in this speech that I know you'd like us to hear with an image that you particularly like. Would you just tell us why you've singled out this particular passage?
Well, I think that for King, the crucial event of the civil rights struggle was the confrontation in Birmingham between Bull Connor and the mostly young people who were marching against his police dogs and the fire hoses. And he focuses on this moment because he understands, and I think he wants his audience to understand, that the forces that they represent, the forces of people marching for their own freedom, are stronger than the forces of oppression.
Here's Martin Luther King.
We aren't going to let any mace stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there, we would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for us. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Bull Connor next would say, turn the fire hoses on. And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out.
It's an excerpt of Martin Luther King's final speech given the day before he was assassinated. Are there any specific issues that you're thinking about on this Martin Luther King Day?
I think for me, part of what I see represented by this day is a time to remember how strong the ideas of Martin Luther King are. We often think of him in a very limiting way as a civil rights leader, particularly as an African-American civil rights leader. But his significance goes far beyond that, and his ideas have had an impact far beyond that. The thing I would like to emphasize is the importance of nonviolent struggles in the world today. We've seen over the last 50 years in so many different nations, in the Philippines and South Africa and Eastern Europe, the way in which struggles that were once assumed could only be resolved through violence were resolved largely through nonviolence. And I think in each of those cases, we see the influence and the impact of Martin Luther King's ideas. He's, in many respects, I think, respected and revered more outside the United States than inside the United States because, again, many Americans tend to limit him by thinking of him simply as an African-American civil rights leader.
What do you think King might say if he were alive today about the politics of race today?
Well, I think, first of all, he would put the politics of race in a larger context. He always understood that the African-American struggle was part of a larger struggle of oppressed people, and particularly people who are economically oppressed. His emphasis on the gap between the rich and the poor, that would be even a stronger message from Martin Luther King today than it was then, because, of course, we've achieved many of the goals that he struggled for in terms of race relations, but we are far away from achieving the goals that he spent the last few years of his life struggling for, and that is the goal of economic democracy, the goal of trying to take care of the needs of those who are most oppressed in our society.
Claiborne Carson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Claiborne Carson, he co-edited A Call to Conscience, the new book and cassette collections of King's civil rights speeches. Carson is a history professor at Stanford University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ain't gonna let nobody love turn me round, turn me round. Marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let Chief Fitzgerald Lord turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let Chief Fitzgerald Lord turn me round. Keep on walking, yeah, keep on talking, Lord.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Max Kennedy remembers the speech his father, Robert Kennedy, made on the day of Martin Luther King's assassination. 2 months later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Also, we talk with soul singer Barbara Lynn, who had the 1962 hit You'll Lose a Good Thing. She has a new CD.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The day that Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy made a speech about King. Just 2 months later, Kennedy was killed by an assassin. On the 30th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination, I spoke with his son, Max. Max was 3 when his father died. When we spoke, he had just edited a collection of his father's speeches. I asked him to read and talk about his father's remarks on the death of Martin Luther King.
My father was scheduled to speak in Indianapolis that evening, and while he was on the plane, he got word that Dr. King had been shot and was going to die. This announcement had not been made public, so it fell to my father to give this terrible news to the people of Indianapolis. And he was scheduled to speak in what was then called the ghetto. And as his escort drove into one of the poorest areas in the city, the police who were escorting him pulled away and refused to drive in. My father's car continued, but the car carrying his speech followed the police officers. So he found himself that night in this very poor area with no speech. And he started by saying, "I have bad news for you, for all of our fellow citizens, and for people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight." And at that point on the recording, there's a terrible gasp from the crowd. And then my father picks up again and he says, "Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice for his fellow human beings, and he died because of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it is perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence there evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness, with hatred, and with a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in great polarization, black people amongst black, white people amongst white, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend, and to replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that has spread across our land, with an effort to understand with compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and distrust at the injustice of such an act against all white people, I can only say that I feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to go beyond these rather difficult times." And then he quoted from memory his favorite poet, Aeschylus. And he said, "My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He wrote, 'In our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God.'" And he finished that speech by asking the people there to go back to their homes and to say a prayer for the family of Martin Luther King, and also to say a prayer for the United States. And the remarkable thing is that that night there were riots across the country. I think there were riots in 186 cities and towns in the United States, and Indianapolis was quiet.
Max Kennedy, recorded in 1998. Here's an excerpt of Sonny Rollins' composition Freedom Suite, recorded in 1958 with Rollins on tenor saxophone, Oscar Pettiford bass, and Max Roach drums. Thank you. Coming up, we meet rhythm and blues singer and guitarist Barbara Lynn. This is Fresh Air. Back in the 50s, Elvis Presley inspired teenage boys around the country to learn guitar and join bands. Down in Beaumont, Texas, another teenager wanted to become the next Elvis, but this one's name was Barbara. Barbara Lynn Ozen had started playing electric guitar and writing songs when she formed an all-girl band in high school. She was discovered by famed Gulf Coast record producer Huey P. Moe. In 1962, they put out a record of Lynn's song, You'll Lose a Good Thing. It became a top 10 hit, and Lynn went on the road with the soul music tours of the time, sharing the bill with Jackie Wilson, Gladys Knight, Stevie Wonder, and Sam Cooke. Lynn had several subsequent minor hits, appeared on American Bandstand twice, and the Rolling Stones recorded one of her songs. But in her 20s, Barbara Lynn started a family and didn't have much time for music. Now at 58, she's back with a new CD called Hot Night Tonight. Let's start with a song from it. This is I Let a Good Man Go.
I let a good man go. Yes, I did. I let a good man go. I never really told him how much I cared, 'cause I didn't realize that man was so rare.
That's Barbara Lynn from her new CD, Hot Night Tonight. Barbara Lynn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Let's go back to your musical beginnings. You got started on piano and ukulele. Where did the ukulele come in?
Yes, when I was a young girl, I played an Arthur Godfrey ukulele. The thing about it is my mother noticed that I was playing the keyboard, but I was also trying to act like I was playing a guitar also.
Kind of like playing air guitar?
Yes. So she went out and bought me a $10.95 Arthur Godfrey ukulele. And I learned, I taught myself how to play some songs from that, you know, and we went on from there. And after my parents noticed that I was so into music, they finally went on and bought me, I should say, a real guitar, you know, a real one then. And I really, you know, then I really took it then, you know, this is what I wanted to play.
What kind of songs had you been playing on the ukulele? Were you playing blues on the ukulele?
Yes, I was playing songs like the things that I used to do by Guitar Slim, and I was also into the B.B. King type music too. And I even admired Brenda Lee's style of singing too, Connie Francis, and you know, people like that, you know.
Now, you've said that Elvis Presley was a big influence on you. What did you hear and see in him that inspired you?
Oh, yes. When I first tuned into Elvis on television, I mean, you know, just like everybody else went wild, so did I, because I liked his style of singing. And I also liked the way he handled his instrument also, even though I'm left-handed and Elvis was right-handed. But when I was in grade school, The kids would tell me that I was trying to wear my hair like Elvis. And I guess I did. I guess I did kind of combed it like that. But I guess I weren't aware of it. But, I mean, because I was just so into his music. I just liked his style, you know.
Now, you formed an all-girl band in high school.
Yes, I did. The name of the group was Bobby Lynn and Her Idols. And although, you know, the Idols didn't stay with Bobby Lynn, though, because, they went separate ways. You know, we had one girl, she didn't want to travel. And then there was another one, I think she had gotten pregnant or something. And so she had to leave the group. But I was very much into what I was doing, and I knew what I wanted to do in the future after I finished high school. I wanted to be a recording artist. So I pursued my career.
This is a good time to hear your first hit, which was recorded in 1962, You'll Lose a Good Thing. Why don't you tell us about this recording session, what it was like for you to be in there and actually doing it?
Oh, okay. All right. First of all, it was very exciting to know that I had a record contract and I was going in to record some of the songs that I had written, that I had ready, because as a matter of fact, when the manager came to me, I was already ready for a full album because I was always writing poems in school. So I was, you know, so that part of it was really together, and especially that one, although that one got a story behind it, Terry.
Let's hear it. Let's hear the story.
The story is I was going with this guy named Sylvester, and we were very young, you know. And I saw him talking to this young lady, and I thought he was going with her, and I told him off about it, and he said no. He said this is just his friend's sister that he was talking to, but there was nothing else that he can tell me. I was very set on saying that this was another girl. So I went home and I boohooed, you know, and I ended up writing words from it the very next day. And he would call and call and say he's so sorry and that this. And I said, Sylvester, there's nothing you can tell me, because if you lose me, you're going to lose a good thing. So I had told him this phrase three or four times, and then to really stop and think about it. And I was already a songwriter, you know, so I said, wait a minute, I can turn this into a song. And that's what I did. And that one song opened a lot of doors for me.
Well, let's hear it. This is Barbara Lynn, recorded in 1962.
If you should lose me, oh yeah, you'll lose a good thing.
That's my guest, Barbara Lynn, recorded in 1962. What was your look back then? What did you wear on stage?
Oh, first of all, I had wigs. Not only I, but all of us. When I say all of us, I mean people like Diana, because we were all out there, you know, on tours, you know, and we all carry those big boxes with the wigs in there.
What kind of wig did you wear? What kind of look was it?
Let's see. Kind of a long wig, yeah. Flipped up. Not under, but up. And the reason why I'm laughing is because right today, if you walk into my home, you'll see a big, giant picture of me with the wig on. And it's in color, though, of course. But that was the kind of look that we had. And sort of like, okay, not bangs, but just sort of a little curl coming down to the right. Yeah.
A spit curl?
So, Yeah.
Now, I think you were underage when you started recording, and I think your producer had to get your parents' permission for you to sign with the record company.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Were they enthusiastic about giving you permission to launch a professional career?
Well, yes and no. Okay, my mother was. My father was a little bit, he was a little bit against it in a way because he wanted me to go to college. And so he told my producer, he said, well, if Barbara doesn't make a hit record during this first trial, she would have to go on to college. And so we all agreed. So I said, okay. So that's when they took me on into the studio, and we recorded the album, If You Should Lose Me, You'll Lose a Good Thing. And You'll Lose a Good Thing was a winner. So my father didn't pester me into going to college. But I wish I would have gone, though, anyway, Terry. Because that was a good thing for him to, tell me that I should go on,
Now, your mother traveled with you on your first tour.
Yes, when I first started, my mother started traveling with me. My father thought it was best because I was green behind the ears being so young. And I hadn't did that kind of traveling before. So when I had to do my first tour, he told her to go on out there with me, and she did. And today I thank her so much. Terry, and she's still living too. She's 78 years old. The reason why I thank her so dearly about it is because at that time, drugs were going out, but not as strong as it is today. And I did not want to be out there for those things anyway. No. I loved her for being out there with me. Oh, yes. I mean, we had good times. And then after I would finish performing, we'd go back to my room and we'd count my money, And that was that was a good part about it. So young, making this kind of money. Oh, boy. No.
Now, the Rolling Stones recorded one of your songs.
Yes, they recorded, Oh, Baby, We Got a Good Thing Going.
How did that come
about? That was exciting, too. Well, I was sitting at my home when I got a phone call from Huey, my manager then. And Huey say, Dahl, well, that's what he would call me. He said, Dahl, I have someone on the other end that would like to speak to you. So I tell him, okay. So he put the guy on the telephone, and he said, hi, Barbara, this is Mick Jagger. I said, who? Mick Jagger? He said, yes, of the Rolling Stones. Oh, boy. And so you must have imagined how I felt and what I was looking like. And I said, well, how are you? He said, I'm doing very well. He said, Barbara, he said, we would like to cover one of your songs. Oh, Baby, We Got a Good Thing Going. And we're here discussing it now with your manager, Huey Moe, and if with your permission, we would like to do it if it's all right with you. So I told him, you have my full permission to record We Got a Good Thing Going. He said, okay. it was really exciting too, Terry,
Why don't we hear your version and their version back to back?
He may talk about me and scandalize my name, but deep down inside, baby, I know you're my only man. So don't worry about me, baby, 'cause I'm right here at home. Oh, baby, we've got a good thing going.
Barbara Lynn, what did you think of the Stones' version of your song?
Terry, I really wouldn't have cared how they would have recorded it, just knowing it was coming from the Rolling Stones. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I still got that copy at home, too. Yeah.
My guest is Barbara Lynn. She's making a comeback with a new CD called Hot Night Tonight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Yeah.
Let's get back to our interview with Barbara Lynn. She's best known for her 1962 hit, You'll Lose a Good Thing. Now she's making a comeback with her new CD, Hot Night Tonight. You got married and had children pretty early in your career. How did that affect your ability to perform and record?
Yes, well, I had to slow down a bit. I had three children. Well, I've got three children, and I've got two girls and a boy, and I had my first child though when I was 29, and so that did slow me down. But Terry, when I was doing my gigs, in fact, for all three of my kids, I always worked up until my eighth month. I was just so blessed to be able to work that long, you know. But I was under a good doctor, But getting back to it slowing me down, it did, though, because I was unable to go into the studio at times when I was called upon to go in and to record another song. I either didn't feel good or I just wasn't for it or, you know, I just didn't have that spirit to go in to sing, you know. Sometimes I was dizzy and that's just it.
Sure.
So it did slow me down for some things, yes.
Mm. Well, you have a son who makes an appearance on your new CD.
Oh, yes. Bachelor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So why don't we hear that track? And this is called You're the Man. Tell us how you ended up recording with him on this track.
Okay. My producer, Don Smith, we were having, I think, Chinese food one night after we had just gotten out of the studio in Aurora, California. And Don's, and well, I had already told Don about Wise. Well, we all, the family call him Wise, his real name, Bachelor Wise Johnson, but I call him Wise. And so I was telling him that I have a son named Wise who is a rapper. I said, although he haven't really made it big yet, but he's, you know, he's still trying. And he said, well, Barbara, you ever thought about maybe putting a little rap in your music here in You're the Man? And so my son went in, and we recorded it, and Wise did his rap part to it.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is You're the Man.
That's the story.
And the queen of blues, putting it down with the sound that you can't lose. Sophisticated with the down-home blues, keeping it true. Busting in a new millennium with something new. Barbara Lynn, she said it before, I said it again. You lose me, you lose a good thing. Hip-hop meets blues, huh? Enough said. Hell of a combo like Oprah and Jenny Craig. It's all about the man and me, doing things on his mic that you can't believe. Your canopy,
hello,
bring your funk to the jamboree. Camelot B, we rolls in a Bentley. Ice on your pinky that chills the hand gently. Dip down on Melrose, watch your sparkle. Put you on a cloud, only heaven and stars go.
I thought I would never find love again. Yeah,
oh. Right here, now, yeah.
But then I met you. Love is strange.
Now that you have a son who would like to be in the music business, does it make you think of when you were young and your mother accompanied you on your first tour?
Yes, indeed it does. And I always tell him, too, be careful what you sign, because your mother, you know, had to get out there. I mean, it was easy for me to get a recording contract at first, but you have to read the fine prints of any contract that you sign. And this is something that I did not do. You know, and a lot of my royalties today has been, I must say, Terry, messed up, you know, because I didn't get what I should have gotten. But I'm like this, you know, I hang in this type of music, I mean, in this type of business, because I love the business I'm in. But I would tell any new artist of today, be careful what you sign and let a lawyer read it. And that's what I tell my son also.
Well, I want to play something else from your new CD, Hot Night Tonight. And this is something that's, it's just you and guitar.
Oh, yes. Oh my goodness,
it's called
yes.
It's Been So Long.
It's Been So Long. I wrote that in about 30 minutes in my room after Don called me and said, Barbara, we need one more song on here. And why don't we do it with just you and your guitar? And I said, Don, just me and my instrument? He said, yeah. I said, you think that's going to sound good? He said, oh, yeah. He said, let's just, you know, Don is the kind of producer like this. He makes you feel so much at home till you just want to record anything, you know. but anyway, so I did what he told me to do. I hurriedly wrote a song within about 30 minutes, and I told him, I've got it. And so he said, okay. And so when he picked me up, we went back to the studio, and we recorded it. And I titled it, It's Been So Long.
Well, before we hear it, let me thank you so much for coming today and for speaking with us.
Oh, wow. I just want to thank you for having me.
Barbara Lynn's new CD is called Hot Night Tonight. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, who also directed today's show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Since I heard from you, been so long, thought we were through. You haven't said a word about missing me, but honey, I've been in misery. But you still look good. Look so fine. Oh, and I still want to make you mine, all mine. 200 phone calls that I made to you, but I couldn't get through to you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Deep in the Heart, a debut novel about love, motherhood, and family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Clinton White House, from the perspectives of two former press secretaries, Mike McCurry, who held the position from 1995 to 98, and Joe Lockhart, who took over at the start of the impeachment trial. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.